But was the point of it that that was just a better way, morally and ethically, to change the original culture?
No, he said something which has not been emphasized by Las Casistas scholars, which is this. He said, if it is necessary to use force to Christianize the Indians, he didn't accept that, but he said if by chance it should, some people thought that, he would rather that the Indians were left unchristianized than be forced to accept Christianity. That is a, I don't know what his Dominican brothers would have thought about that, but he said that. And I think we're faced here with a man of many facets, a man who was a political batter all his life. He didn't have one position always. For a while, he used Indians as servants. He exploited them. He heard Montesinos, but he wasn't convinced by Montesinos in 1511. Only gradually did he come around to this position. So that you have to be sure what period of his life you're talking about. It was not a monolithic structure. However, I don't think he, after his position was solidified and clarified, I don't think he ever went back on his basic thought, one, that all peoples of the world have a potentiality for education. That was fundamental to him. And two, that it was necessary to study other cultures. Even some other cultures were better than Spain. I remember in his great work, Apologetic Historia, the apologetic history, he wrote that the women, Indian women, he thought, had a much saner life, healthy life than the Spanish women because the Indian women worked with their own hands. That he thought was a very commendable thing. He also felt that some of the monuments of the Mayas, for example, the Chichen Itza and all those Maya great monuments, he said he thought that they were comparable to and at least as important as the pyramids of Egypt. This is an artistic archaeological judgment which has been confirmed by modern archaeologists. But those two pillars, I don't think he ever veered from following those two basic thoughts. No, I wouldn't support everything Las Casas said. He said something, he doubtless exaggerated some things. Ramon Menendez Pidal, chapter by chapter, rolled out where he thought Las Casas was wrong or exaggerated or something. But I think today, speaking about the problems which we have in the world today, they're fundamental. And remember also, between the 16th century and today, there were very few people who went to the New World, just as very few people came to Alaska under Russia. I think that most of them were 600 people in Alaska under Russia, 600 Russians, I mean. Cortez had just a small group of people, Pizarro with a handful. That was one of the great things of the Spanish conquest. They did it with a few Spaniards. But today, we have these 750,000 Southeast Asians in the United States. We have in Amherst, Massachusetts, 200 from Southeast Asia. And I mentioned the 1,000 Laos in Rockford, Illinois. In New York City, believe it or not, many of the apartments are owned by Albanians, believe it or not. They feel that the image of Albanians ought to be improved. They consider they're should be, you know, they're not as tough Stalinist. Anyway, many minorities feel their image should be improved. In New England itself, when I first visited my grandfather in Maine as a boy, I heard no French in the streets of Sabattis, a little town near Lewiston. Today you go to Sabattis, over half of the citizens are French-speaking from Canada. And I think I mentioned in the paper, there's a Finnish newspaper published in Lowell, Massachusetts. The people, the possibility for misunderstanding are multiplied because of the movements around the world. And there's no place where there's greater movement around the world than from the other parts of the United States to the United States. Here again, in 1924, the year I got my bachelor's degree at the university, one of the most restrictive laws of immigration ever passed by this nation, 1924, you may remember it, keeping out those Orientals and those people from Southern Europe who had such bad cultures, you know, so low cultures. Today, what do we have? Like a sieve. How can you keep the millions? That's the great problem for the Congress. I think Simpson must only have a bill which they hope to get passed, but there are now millions coming across from Mexico and other countries. So that today, the possibilities for misunderstanding between peoples of different colors, different cultures, different ways of life, and ideas are important. May I mention one of the Mormons? I don't know whether any of you are Mormons here or whether any of you have been to Salt Lake City, but the Mormon Church has done a tremendous thing for the historians of the country by bringing together microfilm copy of records of birth of people all around the world. I've been in the great mountain outside Salt Lake City where they have carved out a whole Rocky Mountain and they have six tunnels. They've already filled 1.5 tunnels with 1.5 million rolls of microfilm of parish records. Each roll contains 1,000 to 1,200 pages. These rolls are from churches, records in various parts of the world. In Mexico, for example, they have microfilmed the parish records of all of the churches where they could operate, some 210,000 rolls. They have many rolls from Korea also, because the Koreans are greatly interested in genealogy, but all over the world. Why do they do this? Why do they spend millions of dollars every year to bring this material? And they have the best microfilm equipment and professionals in the world. They keep this mountain at a certain temperature and moisture. Why? Just because of an idea. They believe that people can be saved retrospectively. It's an idea which I don't support, I imagine other people don't support. They do. And they're very generous in allowing historians access to this, I think, the greatest single collection of material of genealogical nature in the world. Just an idea. In their heads, not ours. So the ideas are important as we go to and fro.
Bishop DeRue wanted ask a question, and Sheldon Kachetag, who is president of the United Tribes of Alaska, who's joined us at the round table, his card says Bernard Nietzschman, but that really isn't Bernard Nietzschman. And then Henry Hsu and Rosita Worrell. And I assume those questions will be, Mr. Goldwyn, will be directed to the matters that are raised by Professor Hanke. And then we'll move on to Sandy Davis to bring us up to date on what's happening in Latin America. And I was hoping that perhaps later, and it may be that Robert Goldwyn has this in mind now, he might want to say something about the impact of the influx of minorities in the United States. The United States is exceptional in that it may be the only country we know of that doesn't have arrangements for autonomy for minorities in one way or the other. I think even Spain itself has arrangements for autonomy for the Basque and other minorities there. And there might be some reflections on that. I can say as a Canadian that we've seen in Canada a great influx of immigration from all over the world, and on a per capita basis, it may be even greater than the influx into the United States. I know that Canada had a larger number per capita of boat people coming into Canada than any other country, including China and the United States, and it seems to me that it is something that isn't quite the same as having a minority of indigenous people. It means that we have six restaurants in Vancouver that serve Vietnamese food, but it doesn't mean that we have minorities that say, we are here, we're entitled to a land base and we're entitled to a measure of self-determination. They come thinking that they will, to a greater or less extent, assimilate. They don't come demanding that there be self-determination for the Vietnamese in Canada or that they should have a land base to pursue their culture and their way of life. But nevertheless, I think we all acknowledge that this enormous influx of people to North America is having a great impact. Well, Bishop DeRue, you're next.
Thank you. I'm not sure if my question is not a bit premature, but I thought that I might raise it now anyway, and it has as much to do possibly with our continuing agenda as with the immediate discussion, which I'm finding absolutely fascinating. It's a little bit related to what Hugh was raising earlier, and it comes across as a certain uneasiness on my part right here as I listen to the very interesting information that's coming out. I have a feeling somehow that our panel here is a very Western panel. And I wonder if at some point before our discussion goes too far, we might not get what I would call a native people's perception of this whole status questionis, of the whole issue. Because we are talking here about the place of native peoples in the Western world. And I would think that maybe the native people's perception would be equally important. And I'd just like to suggest that there is an increasing number of anthropologists who are bringing to our attention that we peoples of the Western world are not the majority, that we are best a relatively small minority, and that it is not at all sure that our so-called modern Western civilization, of which we are so proud, is going to be the last word in terms of civilizations. We came here thinking that the native peoples would eventually disappear, and we might do them a favor by assimilating them into our beautiful white race before they disappeared, to somehow make of them what some would consider a rather superior brand of native peoples. But behind that lies a very profound issue, and that is the perpetuation of the native peoples. As far as I know, they're not about to go away, and they may well be the people of the future instead of the Western world. And I'm just wondering if it might not enrich our discussion here if some parameters of our exchanges here could be set before too long by some kind of a perception of how the native peoples would see this whole question. They might look at it in a slightly different light, I think. And I would just like to know if we might have someone who might help us understand a little better how the native people would perceive this whole discussion.
Yeah. Well, I think that's important, and we have a number of native people at the round table. I should remind you all that we have been to 60 villages and heard from something like 1,450 people, mostly Alaska Natives. So we have a record that is quite remarkable of the ambitions and aspirations and worldview of native people. And I don't think anyone's underestimating its importance. I think the condition we're in is this. You have to start somewhere, and we ask Professor Hanke to begin. And but I think that over the course of the next 4 days, we must indeed make sure that we hear from not just the Westerners who occupied indigenous lands, but from the people who represent the population that is indigenous to those lands. Well, Sheldon Kachetag, I think that you may very well provide what Bishop DeRue is seeking, and so carry on.
Thank you, Honorable Mr. Tom Berger. I would like to first of all say greetings and welcome to a suburb of Dallas. You're up some 30 minutes from the real Alaska, and I would welcome everybody here, all the distinguished guests. I have a copy of a book by Mr. Henry Hsu, and I've been reading with interest what Mr. Hanke has been saying. I'm really grateful that Bishop DeRue would bring up this matter of perspective. It's all good and well to study a people, but as chairman of United Tribes of Alaska, a coalition of tribal governments that have gotten together to provide a larger voice for our people, it's important that I emphasize to you that the survival of Alaska's Native people as a separate and distinct people is in the balance. And I would ask you that when you discuss the position of Native people in the Western world, that you bear this in mind. If nothing is done, if we as governments do not act to preserve and protect not only our people, our land base, our culture, that within a matter of 100 years, our people, a separate and distinct people with a history longer than any other history in North America, as a people, as a peace-loving people that knew how to get along not only with each other, but with our environment, will be gone. And we will end up as Polish Americans, German Americans, and all our descendants can claim, if we do not do something about it, is that they are Americans of Eskimo descent, of Tlingit descent, of Haida descent. In other words, we are being assimilated. This is a roundtable to discuss what we think, ideally and otherwise, are some of the solutions. But it is not just a roundtable. This is the last roundtable hearing of a pretty vast undertaking on the part of Honorable Thomas Berger and the Review Commission to determine not only just the impact of ANCSA on our people, but also where do we go from here. And I would appreciate that, since you are here as part of this study of ANCSA and its impact on our people, that we bear this in mind as we go through these next 4 days. And I would also like to take this opportunity to, since we've been talking about Columbus and all the ramifications thereof and his birthday and his anniversary for so-called discovering America, I would also like to take this opportunity to tell the Native people of Alaska that there is another Columbus Day that they better worry about. And this is not the one in 1992. This is the one on October 21st, 1986. That is when the Federal Lands Management Policy Act, passed in 1976, goes into final approval by Congress. After that day, no matter how right your claim, according to the way the law is written, no matter how right your claim for anything related to land, you have no recourse. And it is important that our people look at this act, because it was passed with no fanfare, and it was part of an amendment to ANCSA, that we should study this thing and find out exactly what we have before us. 1991 is important, granted. But if in 1991 Congress decides, yes, that Alaska Native people do have valid existing rights to not just the corporation lands, but to their jurisdiction, then they will have no recourse to say, but we passed this law in 1976, we gave you 10 years to review this law that cut off your access to any more land, and you did nothing about it. So I take every opportunity that I can to tell Alaska's Native people, hey, don't look at 1991 yet. It's important, yes, but you look at that problem which is more urgent. You have to look at all of these things. And I would also, again, like to thank the ICC for commissioning this review commission and Thomas Berger for taking it on and performing so ably in his capacity as commissioner. And I would like to also to inform the participants in today's roundtable that the impact of Western society in the last 100 years has been great. In 1867, the population of Alaska was some 99.9% Native. 50 years ago, we were 50%. 5 years ago, we're 16%. And yet, Congress, in its wisdom, through the ANCSA, has said that we have a valid existing right to all of this state. And yet, they paid us 3.5 cents an acre for 300 million acres. The NRC has been the first forum, as Mr. Henke pointed out, for the Alaska's natives to be heard. And Thomas Berger did a very commendable job, even though I still hear complaints from villages where he has not had the opportunity due to finances to hold hearings, that we wanted to be heard too. We could not afford what little airfare it might have been to go to whichever town in our area that these hearings are being held. There, people want to be heard, and an opportunity like this, as he said, some 1,450 people have taken advantage of it in the last year. And it's those people, the village Alaskans, on whom ANCSA has had the greatest impact. And yet, they are the ones that have benefited the least from ANCSA. A lot of these problems that have been brought about by ANCSA have their roots not in ANCSA, but in the policy and actions of the federal government prior to 1959, and also the state of Alaska since 1959. The natives of Alaska, through the Department of Interior, have been brainwashed to the point where now our people are, I was asking, sure, we have these rights and everything. Can we do this? And as long as our people have this attitude, everybody is going to say, no, you can't do that. And the point that I would like to point out to the Native people of Alaska is that they do have their tribal governments in place. And that I think it's important that Alaska's Native people research their tribal governments, the recognition of tribal governments by the federal government, and also the rights which the federal government says that we have as Native people. And I would ask for help from whatever source that we can to mount an information, an education campaign, not only to our Native people, but to the non-natives of Alaska as to the actual rights, privileges, and responsibilities of Alaska's Native people to themselves and to Alaska, but also the rights and responsibilities of the non-Native population of Alaska. And to realize that if, in fact, the federal government can get away with a paper conquest of a people, a legislative conquest of a people, and not just one people. There are 7 separate distinct groups of people recognized in Alaska: the Tlingit, the Haida, the Athabaskan, the Aleut, the Tsimshian, and the Eskimo. And there are delineations in each one of those major ethnic groups. All of us
are being conquered on paper. And this information and education campaign is important because we cannot deal with this until we have all the knowledge, all the information available to make a reasonable, rational decision about what to do about it. And here we are, at the end of this month, the Alaska Federation of Natives is having a special convention to make some major changes in ANCSA. Again, through their auspices, AFN Incorporated, because of their activities before they were incorporated, they were recognized as a voice of Alaska's Native people. And they have taken that voice and incorporated it under state law. So now our people are not legally and properly represented. A distinct group of people with governments of their own are now officially recognized through a state-chartered business corporation. It's akin to the people of the United States being told that from here on out, General Motors is a spokesman for the American people, or United States Steel is a spokesman for Alaska's people. And I would ask that we bear this in mind as we go through these next 4 days. It may be just a round table to the Western society, but the recommendations that come out of this commission are very important to the survival of our people as a separate and distinct people with a separate and distinct relationship with the land. And I would ask Mr. Hanke, what parallels and differences do you see between the conquest of the Lower Americas and this paper conquest of Alaska Natives since 1867? And I would also point out that it is really unfair to compare the rights of immigrant minorities with the rights of indigenous people, such as Alaska's Natives. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sheldon. Rosita, I had Henry Shue down and Rosita Worrell. Mr. Shue, please.
Okay, I'd like to say that I appreciate Mr. Kachetak's comment very much, and I certainly hope we'll go back to it because of the way this thing works. You raise your hand when one thing's on the table and something else much more important is on the table by the time you find yourself talking. I do hope we'll won't just drop what's been said, but at the time I raised my hand, what was on the table was this business about immigration, and I. Although I've been working on that the last several years, I wasn't going to get into it except that Professor Hanke has stressed it now. I guess I'd like to make three points about it. First, about numbers. I think it's easy to exaggerate the extent of the immigration to the United States. My understanding is it's not really true that there are millions of people coming in across our southern border if that's supposed to be a net gain. There have been very extensive studies recently of the movement of Mexican workers in and out of the United States. And since it's undocumented and in that sense illegal, of course, it's very difficult to get a grip on. But a group under Jorge Bustamante in Mexico in particular has done very thorough studies. What's being found is that most of the Mexicans who come into the United States also go back. That is, these are workers who are coming to try to earn more money, or to earn some money in many cases, which they couldn't earn at home. And there's a great deal of immigration in, but there's also a great deal back. And many of these people view themselves as still having their homes in Mexico and return to their families every year. We have very fishy numbers about all this. I mean, the numbers we have about movements in are, for the most part, apprehensions by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And one important fact, of course, is that the same person is often apprehended many times. So you can't treat apprehension numbers as if it's numbers of people. Usually when someone's stopped, he just comes back that night or the next day, and he may get counted four or five times. The other thing, of course, is we have absolutely no numbers at all on people going back out again. That's just not counted. The best estimates we have are from the Census Bureau on sort of net gains, and the estimate accepted at the moment is that the net increase from Mexico has been between 3 and 6 million people. It's nothing like a net gain of 1 million a year. While there are many other sort of complications about what everybody recognizes is to some extent a numbers game. But the other two points I think are more important. The second one is, does one view immigrants as costs or as benefits? I mean, these Vietnamese, for example, are enormously energetic and lively and enriching people. So are the Mexicans, who are doing jobs that in many cases need to be done and are very poorly rewarded. And so whatever the numbers are, there's then a separate question of, do you view this as a burden on the country or as a benefit to the country? I think we certainly shouldn't just sort of talk as if it's all a burden. The third question is the one that Mr. Kachetag really raised. What's this got to do with Alaskan natives? And Professor Henke himself raised that question. I guess I'm still just not persuaded it has a whole lot to do with them. First, for sort of two reasons. One is that it's not clear to me that there's any very direct competition. However many people are moving around in the lower 48, it's in a pretty indirect way, I think, that there's any competition for resources with people in Alaska. There's in some abstract way some competition, but that's really quite indirect, I think. But most important of all is the question that Mr. Kachetag raised of, we can't prejudge the question of whose rights are more fundamental. And I would have thought, at least prima facie, that indigenous peoples did have a prior claim, so that if it should turn out that there's a lot of competition, which I don't really think there is, I'm not at all sure it would have to go in favor of the immigrants. Finally, I just stick this on. I think it makes a lot of difference whether we're talking about refugees who are fleeing persecution or whether we're talking about workers who are coming looking for jobs. I mean, there are a lot of different kinds of people in the immigrant side, as well as a lot of different kinds of people on the Alaskan Native side.
Yeah, Rosita Worrell and then Robert Goldwyn.
Thank you, Commissioner. I have just a short statement and then a general question that I'd like to leave with the body. But first of all, I'd like to start off, I hadn't really thought about the commission as being historically significant, because I think most of us are just really concerned about the current issue. But if in fact it is going to be a historical document for the record, I'd just like to share with you one perception of Native peoples of white people. And this happened somewhere in the Southwest when a ship came to the shores, and the Native people over there looked at them and really didn't know if they were really human beings. And Native people in the world, Native peoples here in Alaska, all identified themselves as real human beings as opposed to other types of people. Well, these white people landed on the shores, and Native people looked at them, and they looked like they might be human beings, but they really couldn't verify this. And the group of people came off the ship, and one gentleman needed to take care of a bodily function. And so he started to walk off, and the native people had a sense that they knew what he was going to do. Well, this is tundra country, and the guy didn't have too many places to hide. And so he kept walking, and the native people kept following him, and he walked further, and they followed him. Well, he finally did his job, and the native people concluded, aha, he is a human being. Professor Hanke has said, you know, ideas are important. Ideas are important. It's something that I've struggled with in my pursuit of a higher education, because I have always found a contradiction between ideas, and particularly religious or Christian ideas, and economic behavior. Because the cultures that I come from, ideas are integrated in our economic behavior. Religious ideologies dictate subsistence behavior. And it's something that I've struggled with constantly. But nevertheless, I haven't given up entirely on Western people's ideologies, because I guess I would like to find a way to use Western people's ideologies to protect native peoples. And I think that it was this idea that persuaded many native people to adopt Christianity. We don't have a large body of written material or literature on Native people's perceptions of white people and how they looked at their institutions. But we can, from some of the literature and from some of our oral tradition, get an idea of, you know, how were our grandfathers really looking at Christianity. Well, you can imagine that they lost some faith in their own ideological systems when they found out that those systems were powerless against the new types of diseases that were introduced, when their shamans were not able to deal with the new kinds of sicknesses that were introduced. And they saw the technological superiority of Western people. And I think there's one, in one document, there's one Tlingit chief who says, aha, it must be that your god is white that makes you so powerful. And because of that, I'm going to persuade my people to adopt Christianity. But for me, as a chief, as a Tlingit chief, I cannot desert those who have gone before me. And so therefore, I won't give up my native religion, but I will persuade my people to adopt Christianity. And so I think it was also that Native people also adopted corporations. Their lands hadn't been protected under Aboriginal title. They lost land. And so I can understand that our leaders saw that fee simple title was a way to protect their land. Well, it took some time for Native people to realize that maybe Christianity wasn't all that we thought it to be. And I think many of us are now discovering that fee simple title is not all that it seemed to be. When I went away to school, I learned from my advisor, Sandy Davis, a very important precept, and that was, as an anthropologist, we should study up, not study down. We should look at the institutions and the culture and the societies that impact or affect Native cultures. And so that's a basic theoretical orientation that I have taken. And so it was that I was really, you know, very excited as I read Professor Hanke's book on Aristotle and the American Indians and In Defense of the Indians and the trilogy on Lacasse's works. And I was also very excited when I looked at the Catholic Church's social teachings on economic policy. And I became even more excited when I started to read the literature on the theology of liberation. But yet again, I'm dismayed again when I hear the response from Professor Hanke to the issues raised by Hugh Brody. But yet, I'm not ready to give up yet on Western people's ideologies. But maybe one of the things we can talk about, is it possible for Native people to use these ideologies to protect our land? Or do these ideologies really conflict with Native people's ideologies?
Thank you, Rosita. Thank you very much. Mr. Goldwyn, please.
Yes. So much has been said that is so interesting that my thoughts are in a jumble at this point of things I would have said 10 minutes ago and other things I would have said 5 minutes ago and what I think I'll try to say now. And my only consolation is that we do have several days and maybe I'll have a chance to say many other things if I can control the influx of new ideas which will cause new jumbles. But let me start with the point that Rosita Worrell just ended with, that is Hugh Brody's question. On the one hand, he said, are Las Casas principles of justice, and on the other hand, the ruthlessness of the conquistadores, and they were simultaneous. And how can we account for that? Professor Hanke said he thought that was a cynical question, or it had some cynicism in it. But I think it's two aspects of Western behavior that is very important to for us to think about. That problem was a special Spanish problem, and there is a duality in the American experience and behavior, which is a different duality and I think more relevant for us. In old American documents, you can find statements about the importance of dealing justly with the American Indians. A classic example is the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which was adopted before the Constitution of the United States, but was readopted by the first Congress. And it has, I'm sorry I don't have the text with me, but it has an absolutely faultless statement of what the principles should be of dealing with the Indians, including that there should be no appropriation of their lands except under agreements which are fully understood and with fair compensation. There was for quite a while a rule that there should be no transfer to individuals, but only transfers of lands through agreements made with Congress. And statements of admiration for the Indians and insistence that dealings with them should be peaceful and just. And that was 1787, and it marked the opening of what was called the Northwest Treaty, which is now this not very western or northern states like Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, but it was then the Northwest Territory. An all-out war, first skirmishes, but by 1791 or two, that is, within 4 years, was all-out war against the Indians who lived in that territory, and by 1795 they were driven out completely. That happened simultaneously with these expressions of principles of justice. Now, I don't think it was duplicity, but there's some force there that is an aspect of the presence of these Western non-Native men and women in the same territory with the Native peoples. And I'll leave it for a moment. Also, the principles of equality, the notions that the Indians were, in every respect, men equally with the white Americans, was also expressed officially. There's a message from President Madison to the chiefs of Indian tribes in which he details all the ways in which, in his opinion, the American Indians are the equals of the whites. And that message was a plea to the Indians to improve themselves. And what he said was, look, you are in no way inferior to us in intelligence, in skills, in physical abilities, in courage, and yet we, the people who live in that same territory, the Americans, are well-fed, well-clothed, warm in the winter, and your people are hungry, sick, cold. And what's the difference? Not that you are in any way inferior, but we farm and you don't. And he offered to them to help them become farmers and learn agriculture in their own territory. Well, it didn't happen in an all.